We're closing in on the final episodes of season one, and I wanted to remind you that this thing does not happen without tension climbing. Not only do they make the best wooden training tools on the planet, but they also took a chance on a completely unproven podcast idea because they believe in the value of history and community. When you use the code STONE, that's STONE, for 10% off at tensionclimbing.com, you're letting them know how much you appreciate that support, and it helps us let them know that it was a good investment. So please, head to tensionclimbing.com, tell them thanks, and thank you for your support. Tensionclimbing.com, mastery over success. Audio. 1960, Rome, Italy. The women line up on the track, jogging in place, a few final stretches, nervous energy buzzing through the stadium.
On your march.
A few of the runners brush hair out of their eyes and then take their marks. When the gun goes off, so do they. 11 seconds later, American Wilma Rudolph, the wind at her back, storms across the finish line, the clear winner, with what would have been a world record had it not been for the wind speed, and the first black woman ever to win Olympic gold. At least, that's the story you might have been told. While Rudolph's medal-winning run, and her many wins to follow, including two more that very same Olympic Games that did break world records, are certainly inspiring, monumental even, she wasn't actually the first. See, Wilma Rudolph was following in the fast footsteps of another, an unsung hero. Alice Coachman Davis, then just Alice Coachman, was born and raised in Albany, Georgia, and went to school in Tuskegee, where she reigned as an undisputed track and field star. She claimed not one, not two, not three, but 10 straight high jump national championships, with 50-meter and 100-meter and 400-meter relay championships to boot. Not to mention being a valuable part of Tuskegee's women's basketball team. You know, in her spare time. So why don't we know her name? Well, first, the mainstream media most often tells the easy, most obvious story. Wilma Rudolph would overcome childhood polio and doctors who said she would never walk normally to become the fastest woman on Earth. Which is certainly a story that should be told, but it's also the obvious story. But I can't blame it all on the media. In Alice's prime, the world was at war for the second time. And both the 1940 and 1944 Olympics were canceled. By the time the 1948 Summer Olympic Games in London rolled around, she was winding down her athletic career and looking to move forward in other areas of life. That summer, she broke both the U.S. and Olympic records to take gold in high jump. She was the only American woman to medal in track and field that Olympic year, and she was, in fact, the first black woman ever to do so. It's possible that if those two Olympics had gone forward, she would have won multiple golds for three Olympic Games in a row. But we can only speculate. And that story is harder to tell. And so she packed up her things, headed back to Georgia, and settled into a lifelong career in education. When Wilma Rudolph blazed to her win years later, Coachman had to dust off her old medal and, with a chuckle, bring it in to show her students that she wasn't lying. She really had been the first. History had simply forgotten. Now, I know what you're thinking. Climbing's a little different than track and field. Sure, we're in the Olympics now, but not necessarily the same sport that most of us are practicing. And we don't really have world records. Or, if we do, they're far more subjective. But we do have one thing in common. And that's the ability to edit our history and just well, forget. In our defense, in the 1990s, as the sport boomed, it was hard to keep up. Progress was happening all around, from boulders to big walls, new grades and new ethics, the closing of gender gaps, and the changing of the guard. Climbing was accelerating. Everyone wanted to keep up, to be a part of the momentum. Len Hill, Ben Moon, Wolfgang Gulich, Fred Nicole, Jibé Tribou, you already know their names. It's likely you knew those names long before you heard this podcast. But in the mossy forests of Fontainebleau is a woman whose name, much like Alice Coachman Davis, that you may not know. I didn't. And just like Alice, when you look at her track record, it's pretty shocking that she isn't a climbing household name. Many women from that era are Catherine Destivelle, Lynn Hill, Robin Urbisfield, Bobby Bensman, Katie Brown, Isabelle Patissier, all lauded pioneers, and they deserve their flowers, no question. But don't get it twisted. From literally the start of the 1990s to the end of the decade and beyond, there was one woman who quietly and consistently showed up to the boulders of Fontainebleau and threw down, breaking world records over and over. Her name is Catherine Mikail. I'm Chris Hampton. You're listening to Written in Stone, Climbing's Most Important Ascents. This is Season 1, the 1990s. One, two. We aren't the only ones who hadn't heard of her. While Riley and I were desperately trying to find information, I decided to ask ChatGPT for some help. Tell me about the French climber Catherine Mikail, I typed, hoping for some sort of breakthrough.
I'm sorry, but I don't have specific information about a French climber named Catherine Mikail.
ChatGPT was a bust. Honestly, the internet was mostly a bust. I did find photos of an article about her in a French magazine, and I got those translated. But this was starting to feel like a true crime podcast, except we were the ones who had committed this heinous crime against history. I've tried just about everything, and I suspect she prefers it this way, which leaves me conflicted. While I understand and respect the desire to be private, I also have seen what effect a story like this can have on young girls and women. And honestly, I might have abandoned this episode entirely had it not been for a few things. And I'm not going to tell you where those things are exactly, because I don't want to blow up her spot. But she's put enough out there publicly, if you're willing to spend the time searching, that I feel okay about it. So we're going to piece together what we can. Catherine Mikail was born in Pontoise, France, on December 21st, 1968. A small rural town on the Oise River, just northwest of Paris, Camille Pissarro lived here on and off and painted the town and its gardens and landscapes. In 1875, he painted an impressionistic view of the town looking through the trees from a trail on a hill. He called it the Climbing Path. He had no idea. Catherine was growing up here around the time French climbers were taking to the Verdon and Mont Sainte-Victoire, smoking cigarettes and ditching their aid climbing gear in a free climbing revolution that would lead the way for the rest of the world. She was probably, there are going to be a lot of probably and maybes here, influenced by Parisian culture and the arts, maybe embracing the creative spirit of the country and the time. It's likely that she visited the forests of Fontainebleau, only an hour and a half away, as a child. Artists have been painting the forest for centuries, including several works by Claude Monet, and it's not hard to imagine that young Kathy might have been inspired by the mossy boulders and magical light filtering through the trees. We know she went to some sort of formal visual art schooling later on in life, though, again, we aren't sure which, or why, or where. Maybe she was a really precocious kid, or maybe she was quiet and reserved. Maybe she had other hobbies that paired well with the sport she eventually grew into. Maybe she was a natural, or maybe she had to cut her teeth for a long time on easier terrain. It's possible that she was exposed to climbing early on by family or friends or film or some other venue. Or perhaps she found it later in life. Truth is, we don't know. And I'm not sure that it matters. Because what we do know is that at some point, Catherine McKell walked into the forests of Fontainebleau and accepted the invitation of the bulging and bubbly sandstone blocks there. Quietly, a part of the forest rather than a visitor, she learned the language of the boulders, of the stone, of the friction and the mindset and the attitude. She became fluent. And for the entirety of the 1990s, no one else spoke the language of movement over stone like she did. In the late 80s, as if preparing for what she was about to do in the decade to follow, Kathy began looking at Le Carnage at Bas-Cuvier. It was already one of the most famous and most popular boulders in the forest, as it was the first, possibly in the world, to get the grade of 7B+. She was shy, didn't want to try it in front of people, but couldn't resist the famous block. In 1989, she climbed to the top, becoming the first woman to send V8. She would solidify that grade in the following years, doing several more before any other women had reached the level. And then, in 1996, she exploded. Miss World, the first time a woman climbed 7C or V9. Through 96 and 97, she climbed several more of the grade, including a few in the upper end that are regularly given a slash grade. And in 1997, she finished Halloween for the first female ascent of a solid 7C+, or V10. And by the middle of 1998, she had done several more, including, again, boulders that sat right on the cusp of that elusive 8A grade. Maybe it's because she didn't want the attention. Or maybe because Chris Sharma hadn't quite yet ignited the bouldering craze in the US. Or maybe just because she was a woman or wasn't American, or more likely a combination of all of these things. But the media, the record books, especially in the US, just weren't making a big deal out of what was, in reality, a big deal. Instead, they were telling the easy, obvious stories. But a French woman doing the first female V8, V9, and V10 in the birthplace of bouldering, and several of each grade before any other woman would match her, that didn't seem worthy of American news. And she wouldn't stop there. The magazines would have more opportunities. Still, nothing. We'll be right back. I get it. You want to climb harder and better. Yeah, me too. I mean, damn near everybody wants to. Well, our friends at Tension Climbing understand this desire, and they know how to help you get there. They've combined their near decade of experience building the best training tools on the market with their passion for climbing and their pursuit of mastery over success to create the best training board on the planet. 4 different sizes to fit your space, 2 different layouts, mirrored and sprayed, that you can switch between, and most importantly, it was all done with purpose. These aren't just holds scattered randomly on a board. Those days are history. This is intentionally designed to help you become a better climber faster. Mastery over success. Though, I suspect you're going to have plenty of both. Bouldering was basically invented in Fontainebleau. I know, if you're fairly new and American, you thought it was John Gill, right? We love to attach superlatives to our heroes, but while Gill may have popularized the practice in the States, and maybe did modernize it in a way, he didn't birth it. And no, it didn't begin in the 1940s or 50s, but sometime in the 1800s. By 1900, 37 years before John Gill was even born, climbers were already congregating in the forests of Fontainebleau specifically to climb on the thousands of boulders scattered about. And these days, if you stay alert as you stroll through the boulder fields, you might notice something interesting. A quick flash of blue, a bright orange triangle, a yellow arrow. And these small color-coordinated symbols and numbers are a code, secret to climbers, that serve to link together challenging sequences of boulders, a sort of treasure map meant to be followed. Local legend Fred Bernique was the first to take a paintbrush to the boulders and coordinate them into a particular circuit in 1947. By the mid-50s, the practice had expanded into more circuits of varying color and varying difficulty. And these circuits began as training for alpinism in the nearby mountains, meant to simulate the sustained effort of a long day at high altitude. Over the decades, though, they've been shaped into athletic challenges in and of themselves. And none of these challenges is so famous, or should we say, infamous, as the Franchard-Cuisinière Black Circuit. The Black Circuit is a series of 34 of the area's most challenging boulder problems, from V1 to V11, heavy in the V6 range. Many, if not most of the problems it includes are worthy projects in and of themselves, requiring multiple sessions and multiple goes for the everyday climber. A glimpse of the black paint mark at the base of one of these boulders is a thrilling reminder. Someone, it suggests, isn't just doing this boulder. They're attempting a bunch of boulders like this, all at once, all in a day, back to back, an impossibly difficult dance. Only Finnish pro Nali Hukkataivao has linked all of them in a single day, in the circuit's intended spirit. And that didn't happen until 2019. And like any great work, the Black Circuit culminates in a grand crescendo. Rising from the forest floor at a gentle, not quite vertical angle, this slab doesn't actually look that hard when you walk up to it. Before you pull on, if you haven't done your homework, it might even lull you into thinking you're just going to do it right now, first try. But don't be fooled. Other than a few sloping curves around the start of the boulder, the useful grips are more wish and prayer than actual holds. The term credit card crimps gets thrown around occasionally as a hyperbolic descriptor. Here, though, the term isn't hyperbolic at all. A fingernail seam here and there for hands, a hint of a divot now and again for feet. The most famous 8A in the forest. Duel. For those who know its reputation, it's intimidating. Originally solved by Philippe Laidenmat, it's one of those boulders that, even when you know what you're supposed to do, it still seems impossible when you're on it. Bouldering was growing in an increasingly gymnastic direction, bigger moves, steeper terrain, stone that demanded a new level of creative athleticism, and climbers who were cutting edge enough to deliver. Duel, though, duel required vision and effort of an entirely different kind in an entirely different direction. Climbing in the 90s was about pushing the envelope. Push duel, though, and you're denied. It's not the kind of boulder that can be powered up or muscled through. It stays true to its name. well, requires a sort of mutual respect. There's no demanding of passage. A climber must bring their A game, must stay calm, cool, and humble on every move. Don't, and you're spit off. Do, and you just might be permitted a top. Catherine McHale is small, but mighty. She's also, at heart, an artist. Land art, specifically, is her medium of choice, though she studied visual arts more formally, working with natural elements outdoors is what fulfills her the most. If you stumble upon an intricate design on an obscure rock face in Fontainebleau, made from local clay that will soon wash away back to the earth from whence it came, it might be her work. And the boulder problem around the corner may be as well. While she insists she keeps her art and climbing separate, it's hard not to see a connection. Her relationship to impermanence, beauty, and the great detail with which she sees the natural elements around her seem a great deal like things that would draw one to tango with the intricate boulders of the forest. Boulders like Duell. While many climbers today prioritize bold, decisive movement, to watch Catherine climb is to watch an intricate dance of micro-adjustments. She takes her time, never rushing, making tiny corrections and shifting ever so slightly as she encounters each and every hold. There's a magic of sorts to it. Though she herself never seems stressed, you often find yourself wondering how, on earth, she's still calm, still unhurried. Still on. Duell, with its impossibly small features, punishes equally small mistakes. Success depends on the ability to make even smaller changes. And with an eye self-trained to focus on and appreciate the smallest details of the natural world, Catherine McHale proved a worthy problem solver. At the beginning of the year, she had done Salgosa C, which sat squarely on the slash between 7C+ and 8A. But she knew she was capable of climbing 8A. No woman had climbed the grade yet. For that matter, no other woman but her had climbed 7C+. But she knew. Duell is defined by the Oxford Dictionary as a formal fight with weapons between two people who disagreed, especially over a matter of honor. Yeah, I know I'm American, and in America we just say duel. But let's be honest. Duel sounds far more elegant, and without the elegance, without the honor, it's just a fight. And that's not this. On October 12, 1998, a surprisingly warm Monday, she stood firmly in front of the imposing slab of Duell and carefully chose her weapons. An eye for detail, unhurried subtle adjustments, a massive library of movement over sandstone, art, and a love for the forest. And with a breath, she stepped on and began the dance she had spent so much time choreographing. Not a dance she would do solo, but one she would do alongside the boulder. She never pushed, never demanded. The boulder asked, and she answered. She asked, Duell answered. In conversation, they understood each other. They alone knew the gravity of the moment, the gravity of the ascent, and the gravity that pulled at her feet. But they ignored it all. Moments later, her hand found the top of the boulder, and the dance, the duel, was complete. The 1990s, however, were not. Following March, she would climb her second of the grade via the tiny, delicate, lightly overhanging patinaed crimps of misanthropy. Less than a month later, on April 13, 1999, she again ignored gravity and upped the ante with Liaison Futile 8A+, or V12. It would be 2003 before another woman would reach the level.
One, two.
Written in Stone is produced by me, Chris Hampton, with help from Riley Rush and Emily Holland for Plugtone Audio, a group of the best, most impactful podcasts in the outdoor industry. And at the link in your show notes, you'll find all the things you expect, and probably some you don't, like how you can become a member of the Secret Stoners Club, where you'll find bonus materials and bonus episodes. And look, this show is 100% rooted in the facts, but like Todd Skinner always said, never let the truth get in the way of a good story. And here's the thing, we have only got one story left in season one. So if you love what you're hearing, please give us those 5 stars and a glowing review. And tell every single one of your friends to subscribe and leave a review, and maybe then we can make a season two, and together we can tell the stories of climbing's most important ascents, one decade at a time. Secret Stoners. If you're listening, are you a Secret Stoner? Or is this the first time throughout this entire season that you've listened past the credits? Maybe it was an accident, but you found it, my friend. And this is the Secret Stoners Club. You can become a Secret Stoner as well. You can join the club at patreon.com/secretstonersclub. It's pretty simple. In there, there's extra bonus material. There is a separate feed for the Secret Stoners. If you become a paying member of the Secret Stoners, that's rock stars or legends, then you can have your own Secret Stoners Club feed in whatever podcast app you want. Otherwise, it's there on Spotify for anybody. However, we've only got one story to go for this season. Just one. It's a cool one, but there will be others coming. They just won't be on this feed until the next season starts, which I believe is going to be the end of October again. I need some time off, you guys. I need some time to build up more stories, to figure out this next season. But in the between time, I'm not going to leave you hanging. There will be several short stories and conversations coming for all of you Secret Stoners. Some will be totally free on that feed. Some will only be available to the rock stars and the legends. We'll see what those are as we go. Also, when this season wraps up, there's going to be a giveaway for just the Secret Stoners. We've got more of those custom tension blocks we'll be giving away. We also have several books from Mountaineers Books that I've used for reference this season, and we're going to be giving those away as well. So stay tuned. Today's episode, wow, Catherine McKell. Like I said, I'd never heard her name. Most of you had probably never heard her name, which is mind-blowing to me. There just wasn't much info out there. Like I mentioned in the last Secret Stoners Club, I did reach out to her and I finally did get a response after going through several different channels. But they're busy remodeling and weren't able to get back to me in time for the episode. But I still have questions. So if I get the answers to a few questions, I would love to know from Catherine herself, then I will be letting you all know between seasons a little more information about Catherine McKell, because I just think it's a really cool story. And you know what? She's still climbing. Her tick list is online. It's hard to find, but it's out there. And she's still climbing V11s in Fontainebleau. Wild. All right. I've got to get to working on this final story episode. We're close. We're so close. Riley and I are both working feverishly on it, trying to get it done because it's a mega one, a huge one. A woman who has just not been given the attention she deserves. But that's in 2 weeks. Next week, we're talking with one of the most poetic boulderers out there. He spent a lot of time in Fontainebleau, become an honorary local of sorts, and I'm asking him, because I've never been, to describe the forest for me. And it's at the top of my list now. I really want to make it there. And I'm actually thinking maybe I'll go next spring. Maybe I'll take my daughter out. She'll be almost three by then. So maybe she'll be able to climb on some of these little kid circuits, and she and I will hang out there for a week. Then my wife will meet us out there for her spring break. So a quick 2 week trip, but I'll at least get a taste of the forest. And that person that I'll be talking to next week is Chris Schulte. All right. I'll see you then.